So we're going to start out and focus on the recent evolution of the use of checkpoint inhibitors for non-muscle invasive disease. For each one of these topics, I spent about an hour with each one of the faculty recording a presentation that they've done, which goes through the data in detail and interviewing about their perspectives. We're going to put all that together with this roundtable discussion into a on-demand piece for you all to check out. But Siya, you know, one of the issues that comes up in terms of this first topic that we're going to talk about is the issue of the alternatives to checkpoint inhibitors. Obviously, we're going to talk in a second, and Ashish is the one who actually gave the talk. I'm going to ask him to sort of go through the data. But any thoughts, Siya, about sort of now we're bringing in checkpoint inhibitors much earlier into the disease and some of the challenges clinically you see, Siya, in making that happen?
Sure. I think, you know, one of the challenges is where it's administered in most practices. I think medical oncologists are delivering the immunotherapy. So typically, even in the BCG non-responsive setting, urologists have always been sort of the driver of the additional therapies and are most familiar with additional intravesical therapy. So I think, you know, that's shifting a little bit as IO, specifically Pembro, got approved for the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that's not responsive to BCG. So we're seeing a little shift there, but on the same token, we also have newer agents and or combination therapy that's available to us. So now we have to make a decision. Do we send this patient off for immunotherapy versus try additional salvage intravesical therapy? So I think we'll talk a little bit about that today.
So let's. Here's where we're going to head, and I'm actually going to ask Ashish if he can maybe summarize some of the points that he brought out in his talk. Of course, we're going to focus on the FDA approval and the data behind pembrolizumab, but also data from a SWOG study and looking at atezolizumab in the same situation, and then a couple of cases that Ashish is going to talk about. Maybe we can start out and just briefly comment on sort of how BCG works, Ashish, and the mechanism of action.
So, you know, bottom line, BCG works really well, right? And it works so well because it's such a, for lack of a better term, dirty immunotherapy. It activates pretty much every pathway. As you can see here, in you know, it activates natural killer cells, activates TH1, TH2 misshift or balance. I mean, it's even got activity against viral cytokine storm and suppressing that, but upregulating the resistance to viruses. So really, the mechanism of BCG per se is really complicated, and I don't want to delve too much into it, but as relevant to this particular talk today, the checkpoint inhibition or the PD-1, PD-L1 axis is active when it comes to the BCG mechanism of action. And that's where the thought process came about. Well, BCG is the original cancer immunotherapy. Urologists have used it for decades. Can we now salvage patients who have not had a durable response to BCG, as shown in this study, which is relatively recent from 2014, a randomized study comparing BCG against chemotherapy? You can see that BCG is clearly better to chemotherapy. We know that. But even then, even in the modern era with appropriate restaging and resection of tumor, about 30 to 40% of patients will have recurrence of high-risk disease at 1 to 2 years. And clearly for these patients, we need an alternative. And till date, really, you know, the classification of BCG failure has been all over the place. This is just a table from my talk and our publication that shows, you know, the confusion that exists. But the FDA, in conjunction with experts from the U.S. and overseas, came up with this response definition called BCG unresponsive disease that clearly changed the playing field when it comes to the development of drugs and trials for registration. And mechanistically, the IOs made perfect sense, right? Because if you can activate pathways that are essentially contributing to the resistance to BCG, can we then test that in this population and come up with a paradigm for our patients? And that's really where the whole treatment paradigm has moved now. So in the BCG unresponsive population, the FDA and other regulatory bodies allow single arm studies, and that's Keynote 57 is one of those. Arjun, you know, was the lead on this and presented this at multiple meetings. This is an extract partly from one of his presentations, but partly also from what we presented at the FDA ODAC meeting, which is, again, public domain. And here we presented cohort A, essentially, which was patients with CIS, with about a papillary disease, who were then reported on to the FDA, because the FDA looks at this particular cohort of patients when it comes to approval of drugs, because CIS is a disease state where we're actually treating disease without completely resecting it, and that's cohort A there. So the patients essentially, you know, were presented to the FDA, the data was presented, and it was approved on January 8, 2020, as depicted here. For patients with CIS with or without papillary tumors who are ineligible for or who refuse radical cystectomy. And that's a key determining statement there, because in today's day and age, even though traditionally we've looked at these agents for patients who are not candidates for radical cystectomy, most patients choose not to have a radical cystectomy. And for them, we need options that are not only effective, but also have durable efficacy, and have durable efficacy with appropriate and acceptable side effect toxicity profiles, which I know Dr. Ballara is going to talk about in more detail.
So yeah, I really want to tease out with the four of you sort of how this is really playing out in clinical practice. But I guess one other thing just to sort of get out on the table before we start talking about how this translates to practice is the SWOG study. Ashish, any comments on that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, obviously pembrolizumab is approved, but it's not the only IO agent. Atezolizumab was studied by the SWOG group, which was the study was led by Peter Black and Singh, SWOG 1605. Very, very similar study design to the pembrolizumab study, Keynote 57, with a few salient differences. In Keynote 57, there was no mandatory biopsy required by the FDA. And I want to specify that required by the FDA is a key statement. It's not as though the company or the PIs did not want to do a biopsy. And discussions with the regulatory bodies, the FDA did not ask for a biopsy, whereas in SWOG 1605, they requested a mandatory biopsy at 6 months. But otherwise, the study design was very, very similar. This study did have to close early because of some stopping rules with toxicity, which unfortunately, you know, there were some adverse events on this study where the trial had to close. But the results are very, very similar to that which we saw in Keynote 57. So if you look at the six-month biopsy mandated response rate in atezo, very similar to extrapolated data from Keynote 57. And if you extrapolate the data from this trial to the three-month response rate, about 40-41%, again, very similar to what we saw in Keynote 57. The durability of response is something that has not yet been reported by the PIs of the study at any public domain meeting, so I can't comment on that per se, because obviously that's still confidential, but that's probably what the FDA is going to look at when they go in front of them for approval purposes.
So I've got to say, to me, this is one of the most interesting developments in all of oncology. You know, so amazing, really, to have to think this thing through the way it is in terms of the clinical situation, Sia. Can you comment a little bit, you know, as a medical oncologist, when she's put up that, you know, list of, you know, different states of BCG, unresponsive or, you know, whatever, can you maybe put that more into a clinical context, Sia, of what the typical clinical situation is where you're thinking about this kind of strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. So this will, you know, when we see a patient with high risk, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, fairly straightforward. Everybody goes to BCG if we can get it. And then we reevaluate the patient at 3 months. They may or may not be okay at that point, but let's say at 6 months you have a suspicious lesion, go to the OR, and now you have recurrent. So at 3 months, you would be getting a maintenance 3 month, 3 week treatment of BCG. So you've received your 6 week induction plus a 3 week maintenance, and at 6 or 7 months, you have a recurrence. That patient is deemed to not be responding to BCG, and we don't recommend any further BCG, whether it be CIS, TA, or T1. Now, I think that's a very, very important point, what kind of disease we have. If we have focal CIS, a small high-grade TA tumor, and we resect those things and the patient is disease-free, we're going to think about that a little bit different than the patient who actually progresses from TA or CIS now to T1 disease. We're not even thinking intravesical therapy at that point for patients who are progressing to high-grade T1 disease. So for those patients, we recommend a radical cystectomy, which will hopefully be curative in the vast majority of those patients. But for the patients who have these focal TACIS recurrent tumors that are not responding to BCG, that's what we're talking about, the ones who within the year are recurring, and now we have to make that decision between salvage, intravesical therapy, and immunotherapy.
So, Arjun, I'm curious about your perception about how this plays out. Again, to me, it almost seems unique in oncology. Mm-hmm. It's one thing if you have a patient who's not going to be eligible, refuses, no way they're going to have a cystectomy. That's one thing. But for the patient who is a candidate, it's just such an interesting decision, I think, at least at this point, yeah, in terms of cystectomy versus going this other route versus other further intravesicular therapy. Arjun, any comments about how you see this playing out in practice as it's being discussed with patients?
Yeah, so I mean, a little bit of this is an evolving area because you know, before January, it was to counsel a patient about their options outside of cystectomy. It was in the realm of protocols, right? And so January, all of a sudden, the drug is FDA approved, and basically, you know, and there's a little bit of bias here, right? So by the time the patients are referred to me, they're clearly interested in bladder preservation options, and so the conversation naturally steers toward that. You know, the complexity really relies on making sure the patients understand what they're getting into. You know, patients obviously are looking for options that avoid cystectomy, but in non-muscle invasive disease, it is highly curative. And so patients must know that, is that their most curative option is a radical cystectomy. And then they're counseled about the risks of it, the long-term consequences. And if they're willing to accept the risk of saying, well, listen, let's try something different, then I think immunotherapy is a very good option. The important thing is that even after, you know, treatment, they get four cycles of treatment, and they get a cystoscopy. And in the protocol, if the patients didn't achieve a CR at 3 months, and that's a notable, you know, difference between that study and other ongoing studies in non-muscle invasive disease, is that at 3 months, if you didn't have a CR, you came off study. And so that's how, you know, we probably should use it in the real world, which is you get kind of one shot at it. And if at 3 months it's not working, then a patient should be redirected towards surgery.
So, Jonathan, we did this survey of some docs in practice, community-based practice, urologists, as well as medical oncologists. So we said, would you generally offer pembrolizumab to, we said in this case, a 50-year-old otherwise healthy patient with BCG unresponsive disease? And the majority of both oncologists and urologists say yes, but, you know, a fairly significant minority would say no. And that minority starts decreasing with age. So 70, you see much more, and then 80, even more. Jonathan, can you talk a little bit about, you know, I don't know how often you see the patient as opposed to your urologist, but how you think through the trade-off here, Jonathan?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like patients often, depends on how you frame the question to them, and depends on the risk of their disease. And so as an oncologist, I tend to unfortunately only see the highest risk non-muscle invasive patients, ones who probably are going to do better with cystectomy in my mind than pembrolizumab. And so, you know, I think it's a tough job counseling them. And then, you know, I feel like I have to talk them out of pembrolizumab in order to let them get pembrolizumab. And maybe a surgeon might feel differently about that, because I feel like I may be missing a curative window. But there are also patients who have a prolonged natural history, who've had CIS forever, and it's not extensive, and they've never had the sort of, we know that a long natural history of their disease suggests that it's probably not going to metastasize in the next several months, so therefore those patients are pretty reasonable to pursue a novel approach like pembrolizumab.
So, I'd like you to listen to Ashish's case. He has a case here that I'd like to get your feedback on. We actually have a poll question we're going to ask to the audience based on this case. So we say here's a 68-year-old man with has a TURBT, PT1 high-grade urothelial bladder cancer plus CIS, second resection, PTICS. BCG is started, cystoscopy after 3 months as a 0.3 centimeter papillary tumor, blue-aided TURBT, PTA low-grade UBC. So, Sia, what would you be thinking about? Is this BCG unresponsive?
No, it's not. You have essentially a very small low-grade cancer. What we really care about is a high-grade cancer. So BCG, I think, has done its job. We don't expect it to work very well with low-grade tumors, but it's really irrelevant. We would make sure that the pathologist is confident with that diagnosis. This scenario doesn't happen often, but it does, where you have the coexistence of low-grade and high-grade disease. So absolutely, we can continue BCG maintenance, and none of the trials that I'm aware of, or very few of them, would this be considered a stopping factor. So we'd continue as long as we don't have any high risk. So the CIS has gone away, the high-grade lesion has gone away, and we're left with a very small low-grade lesion that probably was picked up with the blue light alone, which hopefully will be completely resected and done away with.
So it looks like the majority of the audience agrees with you. Some say, I don't know. Probably they're medical oncologists like me who don't know about it at all. But I just found it really interesting, exciting, though, to hear about all these interdisciplinary factors. So Ashish, maybe just briefly tell us what happened with this 68-year-old man.
So really, the point I wanted to make by highlighting that particular case was exactly what Sia mentioned, which is when you have an immunotherapy such as BCG, it's usually going to work against the tumors that have a high mutational burden, which is the higher grade, more aggressive cancers. And if BCG has essentially allowed this patient to be free of high-risk disease, the low-grade recurrences, while a nuisance factor, are not a reason to consider that this patient is falling into any sort of BCG failure or BCG unresponsive category. And in fact, even on clinical trials, the FDA allows patients with low-grade disease to be considered to have a non-event per se. So really, in this case, low-grade recurrence was not a failure, and the patient continued on and did fine.
Ashish, how about this 62-year-old woman?
This case is one that I brought up to highlight a patient with T1 high-grade disease that had a resection. It was 1 centimeter, fairly classic tumor. What's not classic here is the fact that this is a healthy bladder cancer patient, but I didn't want to put that in there so there's no discussion about, well, patient can't tolerate a certain therapy. This patient elected to undergo BCG, had 6 weeks of BCG. At the three-month evaluation was NED, got maintenance therapy, and at 6 months had a positive cytology, blue light was performed, and the blue light here, again, as Sia mentioned, picks up things that we might not have seen 8-10 years ago, but picked up CIS. Now, this patient really said she cannot undergo any organ removal, just refused radical cystectomy. So in this patient who does fall into that highest risk category, T1 high grade with CIS, the options really, when you counsel this patient, are, well, we can't do a radical cystectomy, which is what I would recommend she consider. What other agents do we have? And we talked about intravesical gemcitabine and docetaxel combination, which really has a remarkably high response rate, even though the caveat there is that's not prospective studies, it's multi-center retrospective evaluations. But the response rates are anywhere from 58 to 70% durable at 1 to 2 years. But clearly, the approved drug is what this lady chose, which was pembrolizumab. And it's early still, obviously, but just to highlight that we do have an option that we can talk to the patient about that's approved and available.
So we're going to move on to talk about our next topic, but I do want to ask Sia, you know, when we chatted, you were bringing up the issue of, you know, intravesicular therapy as an alternative to pembrolizumab, and just kind of curious how you would have thought through this case.
Yeah, a great question. And I think Ashish brought up some of those. Gem-Doci has been around for quite some time, and now we have some retrospective series looking at the 1 and 2 year results of up to 50% durable response rate. So we'll see. You know, hopefully we'll have some prospective data soon on that as well. But you know, other drugs are going to get approved in this space, namely Adstiladrin, which is, you know, has about a 25% complete response rate at about a year. So, you know, there's going to be some competition in this space. If you think the patient this is a high risk patient. So I think, you know, having had invasive disease to begin with and having had the recurrence, it may make sense to use more of a systemic therapy than intravesical therapy. But if you have small CIS lesions in the bladder that they're non-invasive and you know BCG is not working, perhaps those are better suited for continued intravesical treatments.
So Ashish, a couple questions from the audience. What about another round of induction BCG? Somebody else says, what about mitomycin?
So clearly that's the whole reason for this a clarification of this disease state. And in fact, there's data from the 1980s, right, where with increasing rounds of BCG, you're decreasing the response rate, but increasing the death rate of the patient because it becomes an exercise in futility. So if the patient has really met the criteria for BCG unresponsive disease, that is an indication that more BCG is futile. So I wouldn't recommend more BCG in this particular patient. Whether you use another intravesical agent in the absence of an approved drug, which we expect that Stilodrin will be approved, you know, in full disclosure, it was developed at MD Anderson, but it's not approved yet. So non-approved drugs, single agent chemotherapies don't have as robust a response as combination chemotherapies, again, which makes sense. And that's why for these patients, yes, mitomycin has been considered an option in the past, but nowadays we use combination. So some people use mitomycin and docetaxel. Gemcitabine and docetaxel tends to be better tolerated. So that's what a lot of us use.
Another person in the chat room, she says, what about interferon?
So interferon was one of these drugs that got a lot of attention back in the day. Mike O'Donnell did some studies trying to study interferon. And in phase two studies, it did look like interferon would salvage about 35-40% of so-called BCG failure patients. But when it was actually compared head-to-head against BCG, there was no benefit to adding interferon. And when you look at the longer-term data from those studies, the patients that appear to need interferon the most, which is the BCG unresponsive cohort, will not respond to interferon. So the ones that respond are actually the ones that were misclassified earlier. And interferon's really fallen out of favor. It's not even made anymore for this purpose.